Hi, folks. Welcome to the Socialist Resurgence podcast. My name's Ernie Gatta. I'll be your host for this episode. And what's going on? Are you worried about the increasingly hostile rhetoric towards war coming out of the media? Are you worried about the growing conflict between the world powers, between the imperialist powers? Because it sure seems like there's a new military buildup between the U.S., the EU, Russia, China. The world's forces seem to be looking to redivide the resources and markets for their own interests. There seems to be a crisis building up around that. And right now it's centered in the Ukraine. And on the one side we have Russia with its army built up, deployed around Belarus and, you know, on the borders of Ukraine. We've seen their recent military incursions in Kazakhstan and, you know, different interventions in Belarus and other areas in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And for us here in the U.S., we've seen the continued aggression of the U.S. war machine. We've seen NATO, building up around the borders of Russia. We've also seen new alliances between China and Russia, deepening their relationship economically, possibly militarily. We don't know. Are you concerned about this? Are you worried about all of this? Well, we decided in Socialist Resurgence to have a class this past Sunday on February 13th to discuss inter-imperialist rivalry, but more specifically, to discuss the working class response to imperialist rivalry. Because it's easy to fall into the trap of saying, okay, well, the U.S. is the bad guys, they're the evil superpower, and, you know, Russia and China represent resistance to U.S. imperialism. Well, the reality is, on the ground, that there are new emerging imperialist powers. That's Russia and China. And that has certain consequences for the world, for the world working class, and for how we as workers respond to the threat of the conflict that these powers might enter into. And the class that we gave is broken up into three parts. The first part is by Keith Laurie, who's the author of this really great paper on Russia, imperialist power with regional clout. Which you can see, it's a document posted on our website at socialistresurgence.org. And Keith goes into, you know, the history of imperialist war from World War I to World War II, and how, like, today, you know, for the last 70 years, it was really impossible to imagine, you know, the great powers going into conflict again. But here we are, we see the potential for it. The danger of it is very real. And we have to find a response as workers. We have to find a response when the capitalist class is threatening to send workers to war against one another. What type of response do we have? How can we fight back? And so this class gets into it. And Keith kind of gives us the historical framework for that struggle. And then you'll hear me second on this. I don't know what happened with the audio quality. For some reason, it might have been going through my headphones. It sounds like I'm speaking, you know, from another room or something, but bear with that. But I think what you're going to hear is important, because it talks about the capacity of the workers in Eastern Europe and Central Asia to actually lead their own struggle against imperialist powers, and how they're a central part of fighting imperialism on a world scale, and the potential for that, digging into some of the different working class struggles that have existed in Belarus, Kazakhstan, Poland, Ukraine, and so on. Finally, you're going to hear Christine Marie, who's a longtime anti-war activist. She's been organizing since the Vietnam years, played a key role in building mass mobilizations against Washington's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, played a central role in building a independent mass movement perspective within the anti-war movement. And she's going to, you know, discuss, you know, how do we, you know, rebuild the anti-war movement? How do we, again, put, you know, thousands, if not millions of people in the streets? And it's important perspective because right now we haven't been able to mobilize hundreds of thousands of people. I remember, marching February 15th, 2003, right, you know, a month before the invasion of Iraq. We had 500,000 people in New York City. It was incredible. It was my first really mass, you know, mobilization, and it changed my life. And these mass movements have a transformative quality to them that when we're thinking about, you know, how do we not just fight back and end a war, how do we actually change society? It's these type of actions that really inspire and push people to think about these bigger questions. And Christine is going to, you know, really talk about how, you know, we can get back to that point and what we need to do to get back to that point. So if you have any questions, if you have any comments, please feel free to reach out to us on our website, you know, and enjoy the class. I hope you get something out of it. Each part is about 20 minutes, so it's about an hour long. And after that, I hope to see you out in the streets on a picket line, fighting, you know, imperialist wars, supporting strikes and workers' movements around the country. And guess that's all. Enjoy.
All right. Thanks so much. And thanks, everyone, for coming out today. So today, obviously, we're giving this talk, this panel, in the face of a serious crisis in Eastern Europe, with Russia deploying more than 100,000 troops to its border with Ukraine and carrying out military exercises in Belarus and the Black Sea, while the U.S. and major powers in Europe are deploying new troops, ships, and planes to the region to supplement their existing forces. Every day, we have a new report of the possibility of a Russian incursion or invasion into Ukraine and of the potential moves of the U.S. and other powers for sanctions, military aid, or other interventions. Socialist Resurgence sees the United States, as well as the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and Russia, to list some of the leading participants in this confrontation, as constituting imperialist powers. And by that, we mean that they're states dominated by the economic interests of capitalist classes, which are highly concentrated into monopoly and oligopoly structures, which use their military, economic, and diplomatic weight to engage in large-scale exploitation of workers and peasants on an international scale. We further see conflict between these powers as fundamentally deriving from the conflicts of these interests and from the global struggles for profits, rather than the proximate circumstances of any given crisis. In response to this situation, we raise demands for no U.S. troops in Eastern Europe, an end to U.S. and Russian intervention in Ukraine, and solidarity with workers and farmers in Ukraine, Russia, and elsewhere fighting against war. We seek to build a mass anti-war movement in the United States, which can put thousands of working people into the streets. We believe fundamentally that the working class is capable of fighting against inter-imperialist war and winning. And we think that only a victory by working people is capable of decisively overcoming imperialism and its system of brutal wars. We raise these demands and we hold these beliefs with the conviction of lessons taught to us by the experience of the socialist movement in fighting against inter-imperialist wars in the past. The First and Second World Wars constitute the most important of these conflicts and experiences. These wars were incredibly devastating experiences, with the First World War resulting in more than 17.5 million deaths, and the Second World War producing more than 73 million deaths. Both, of course, also yielded tens of millions more injuries, while also inflicting enormous devastation in the areas fought over or bombarded. The overwhelming majority of the horrific human, economic, and other costs fell upon workers and peasants around the world. Consequently, we think it's of great importance as we face a new era in which the potential for inter-imperialist war again looms large, to review the history of socialist activism during these wars. When a diplomatic crisis in 1914 between Serbia and Austria-Hungary over the assassination of the Austro-Hungarian Archduke Franz Ferdinand escalated into a declaration of war and the eventual drawing in of every major European power into this conflagration, the socialist movement initially seemed to be in a position of real strength. Its leading parties counted millions of adherents in Germany, France, and elsewhere, and they were joined in an international political organization, the Second International, which had recently adopted resolutions decrying the possibility of war between major imperialist powers. A combination of the existing weaknesses of the Second International and the extreme pressure of the situation, however, exploded the unity of the Second International and saw most of its national sections offering political support to the war efforts of their respective countries. The most important elements of these were an upsurge in initial patriotic sentiment among workers at the start of the war, demands by governments of the warring powers for conformity and unity under the threat of repression, the reluctance for parties which had adopted strategies of slow reforms of the existing state as the route to socialism to break from said states and risk their defeat and collapse, and the portrayal of their own imperialist powers' struggle as in some way progressive. The German Social Democratic Party, or SPD, pointed to the supposed need for Germany to defend Europe against the barbarism of Tsarist Russia. The French section of the International identified as paramount the struggle against the ruthless German Kaiser, and so on and so forth. These capitulations to the national governments of the imperialist powers provided a left cover for these governments that they could argue that their war efforts were justified, and you could look, even the socialists were supporting it. Not all the socialist movement was captured in the thralls of social patriotism, however. In Germany, the SPD Reichstag delegate Karl Liebknecht boldly defied the party to vote against war credits in December 1914, despite facing arrest and conscription for this action. Importantly, in Russia, the Bolshevik Party stood apart from this growing collaboration and consistently fought against the war. The anti-war wing of the socialist movement reorganized with a series of conferences beginning at Zimmerwald in Switzerland. And as the war dragged on, the initial outpost of patriotic sentiment faded, and workers and peasants increasingly turned against the war, giving an opening to those who had consistently opposed it. The most effective resistance to the war proved to come from Russia. In February 1917, demonstrations in Petrograd on International Women's Day against the war and the stringent rationing system sparked dramatic mass strikes and street confrontations, which escalated into the revolutionary overthrow of the monarchy. When the elements of the socialist movement in Russia, which had supported the war, joined with bourgeois forces to establish a provisional government which continued the war, workers and peasants continued to struggle mightily against it, with mass demonstrations in April 1917, for instance, against an effort by the provisional government to uphold the war demands of Russian imperialism, which had been negotiated with the UK and France, including plans to annex what is today Istanbul and other territories, forced a public abandonment, at least, of those claims. In the end, what proved decisive in the struggle against the war in Russia was that the workers and peasants in Russia were able to take power, with the Bolshevik Party leading a new revolutionary upsurge in October 1917. the new Soviet government denounced the war. It denounced the imperialist demands that had been put forward by the previous Russian governments. It published the secret treaties that these governments had conducted with the Entente, revealing their designs to divide up the world into colonies and spheres of influence. And it called for a peace on the basis of democratic self-determination without annexations. Indeed, these demands proved so popular among working people worldwide that even the imperialists felt the need to make at least nominal concessions to them. Woodrow Wilson's famous 14 points were designed to put a fig leaf of pacifism, democracy, and self-determination over the war goals of the Entente, and to try and prevent adherence to this call coming from the Russian Revolution. When honeyed words failed, however, and workers across Europe and elsewhere fought for gains toward the end or in the aftermath of the war, which was, of course, concluded on the basis of new annexations, establishments of colonies, reparations, and a redivision of the world in favor of the victors. They did not, however, hesitate to brutally repress them. And working people all around Europe in particular were involved in conflicts that resulted in horrific devastation and their repression, despite all the promises that the imperialists had made about a national unity and how the war was being fought for the interests of the country as a whole. As the threat of inter-imperialist war again rose with the and then exploded into the Second World War, there was once again a major struggle between social patriotism, the adherence to the war demands and the war policies of the imperialist governments, and a socialist movement fighting on an international basis against imperialist war. By this point, the socialist movement, which internationally had reorganized revolutionary socialists into the Comintern, had unfortunately fallen under the sway of a Stalinist center in the Soviet Union, which, instead of putting forward a consistent anti-imperialist program, instead jumped between opportunistic dives toward one or another imperialist power, first allying with France and the United Kingdom against Germany, and then concluding arrangements with Germany against France and the United Kingdom, and then in the aftermath of German invasion, once again returning to an alliance with the United Kingdom and as well as the United States in opposition to Germany. These pivots and swings helped to undermine the potential for a mass struggle against the imperialist war, but nevertheless, important struggles were still conducted by those socialist elements that continued to be opposed to imperialist war. In the United States, for example, the Socialist Workers' Party played an important role everywhere from the Teamsters in Minneapolis to the trenches on the front lines, arguing for consistent working class opposition to imperialist war and building the foundations of struggles to come. In particular, at the end of the war, the United States government attempted to maintain large-scale deployments of U.S. troops across Asia in an effort to stem the potential for nationalist and communist movements to seize power against the colonial regimes. And these efforts were severely hindered by movements among both the GIs and workers at home to demand the repatriation of U.S. troops and to oppose their use as a police force in the region. In addition, World War II ignited a series of huge struggles in the colonial world as peasants and workers across the world saw their own supposedly invulnerable powers swept aside and smashed on the battlefield, and saw that they could, in fact, fight and win struggles in their own interests. And of course, many of them also took part in the war with huge usage of colonial troops, in particular by the United Kingdom and France. these struggles exploded into the wave of anti-colonial sentiment and uprisings that carried out across the world following the war and resulted in the establishment of the independence of many of the states that exist in the world today, at least on a formal basis. So what are some of the lessons that socialists can learn from the two world wars and the struggles that took place during them? Well, first, we can't lend any credence to the excuses and justifications that are put forward by the imperialist powers to their wars, regardless of what side is the aggressor or the defender, regardless of what casus belli is offered. Imperialist powers are everywhere and always fighting for the interests of their own monopoly capitalists and for the redivision of the world in their own favor. Their aims are hostile to the interests of working people in both the imperialist countries and in the colonial and semi-colonial world. Socialists have a responsibility to fight against all imperialist powers in these wars, and for those living inside of one, there's a specific responsibility to fight against our own imperialist power, as this is the place in which working people have the greatest leverage to fight against them and to try to convert the struggle to one waged by working people for their own interests. Furthermore, we see that the greatest victories that we were able to win against imperialist war and against imperialist domination are victories in which the working class and peasants were able to fight and struggle and take power. Only in these circumstances was Russia able to withdraw itself from the First World War. Only in these circumstances were many of the colonial struggles around the world able to overturn both the formal colonial rule and collaborationist governments set up on their behalf, and really consistently win any degree of genuine independence. Furthermore, we see that what we need to fight for is not a redivision of the world in terms of creating some kind of equality between the stronger or weaker powers, or creating some kind of adherence toward a lesser power that will offer some better deal to the world. Instead, what we need to fight for is the defeat of imperialism on a global scale and the establishment of workers' power in socialist republics on a global scale. And with regard to the struggles, we also see that working people within a particular imperialist power have incredible power to impact the course of the war, to impact their participation in it, and to actually win struggles against them. Working people are not powerless, and they can make a truly enormous statement and reverse incredible things when they are able to organize and exercise that power.
Thanks, Keith. All right, so I'm next. And I'm going to be kind of focusing in on the class struggle in Eastern Europe and Central Asia as it relates to this growing inter-imperialist conflict, and in particular, the capacity of the workers to make change and to fight against imperialism. And the workers' fight, you know, against exploitation in the region is actually very dynamic. They're finding themselves at the center of this conflict, as Keith had pointed out, to redivide markets and resources. And that really has the potential to drag the entire world working class into another world war, as we heard about the first two. And right now, the bloody wheels of this, you know, U.S. war machine and NATO have really been grinding on for my entire adult life. I was, as we were you know, developing this class, I was thinking about, you know, driving down to Washington, D.C. In January 2002, right around Martin Luther King Jr.'s holiday, to attend my first anti-war march against the war in Afghanistan. And in 2003, on my birthday, the U.S. invaded Iraq. And year after year, I celebrated by, you know, heading out to mass marches to end the wars and occupation. And back then, when I first got active, the U.S. was the main power driving forward an imperialist agenda and threatened the lives of workers across the Middle East and elsewhere. And in the past 20 plus years, new imperialist powers like Russia and China have emerged. And you can read, like, as I mentioned earlier, you can read more about these positions on our positions on imperialism at socialistresurgence.org in the documents section. And these new powers are trying to carve out their own share of the markets, the resources, and access to cheap labor. And this conflict has the potential to, you know, drive us closer and closer to war. And we need an anti-war movement, but the truth is, some folks in the anti-war movement say we need to give political support to Russia and China against U.S. aggression, as if the class forces had remained frozen in time. The recent meeting between Putin and Xi and the statement they released clearly shows how much things have changed. Russia and China do not represent a progressive force in the world. U.S. and Russian investment or Chinese investment have the same negative impact on the working class. And those who want to give political support to Russia, an imperialist nation, are supporting the repression of working class struggles in Belarus and Kazakhstan and elsewhere under the cover of fighting terrorism. That sounds familiar. Are the striking oil workers in the western region of Kazakhstan terrorists? No, they're not. But the capitalists think those workers are terrorists because they threaten to disrupt the flow of oil and, most importantly, the flow of profits. When we express our international solidarity, we cannot tell the world working class to place faith in Putin or Xi or any leader of an imperialist power. We have to be clear that the self-organization and independent actions of workers, as Keith had described, will be the driving force to defend the working class. Is it realistic for us to think that the workers in the region can wage a struggle to stop the war and ultimately take power? I think so. These workers, their great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents helped make a revolution a little over 100 years ago, as Keith had described, and their families grew up under a worker state that, even under the brutality of Stalinist regimes, saw the rapid transformation of their world from a feudal agrarian society to an industrial collective workshop in the span of a few decades. And despite the Stalinist degeneration and eventual collapse of the Soviet Union, the capitalists have still not wiped clean the legacy of workers' struggles and nationalized industry and the worker struggles that nationalized industry and gave the land back to those who worked it. Struggles for democracy and to maintain whatever gains still exist in former Soviet states like Belarus and Kazakhstan present two very good examples that I'll discuss in a bit. Poland and the women's movement around abortion also provides us with some insights. In the Ukraine as well, workers are struggling through the assault on labor, through labor forms and privatizations of the remaining state-owned enterprises. In Russia too, workers are organizing. And we really could point to any number of labor and social struggles across Eastern Europe and Central Asia to make our point that the working class is going to be the red wedge driven in between the imperialist powers and any developing conflict over resources. So let's talk about Belarus. It's a good example of a country today where legislators are driving forward laws for foreign investment to take over state-owned companies. The workers have great potential to cripple the economy, but strikes are difficult due to repression and retaliation. The country has a long history of class struggle, including the fight for greater workers' democracy against Stalinism. The recent uprising for democracy against Belarusian President Lukashenko and his mix of extremely bureaucratic post-Soviet era government with the brutality that was unleashed by the capitalist market is an undeniable challenge. The resistance of trade unionists in Belarus during the 2020 uprising, despite decades of repression, was highlighted during the country's mass mobilizations and strikes against what many felt was a fraudulent election. Workers organized strike committees and prepared for a general strike. They demanded new elections, free political prisoners, the democratic right to protest and not be fired. Workers in the Belaruskali, the world's largest potash, which is a potato fertilizer, if you're not familiar with it, and the Minsk wheeled tractor plant, even heckled President Lukashenko when he made stops visit, tried to, you know, win the workers over. The Belarusian Congress of Democratic Trade Unions released a statement, quote, "The strikes now underway in the country show the growing political activity of working people. This regime, illegally clinging to power, is leading the country towards economic collapse, towards the bankruptcy and closure of businesses, the loss of jobs, and the impoverishment of people," end quote. The regime in Belarus ultimately was saved due to a brutal crackdown that saw thousands arrested following the August 2021 strike actions across the country. The recent increase in military deployment of Russian troops around the situation in Ukraine is also serving a dual purpose of intimidating the working class. Now let's look at Kazakhstan. And it's a similar situation there. Kazakhstan is in the process of restructuring the capitalist economy to suit the needs of the IMF and Western investors, both of whom are reacting to the continuing global economic downturn, the need for more extreme extractivism, and the giant land grabs through which they hope to make profits as climate change disrupts food production. A capitalist economic development group, the OECD, reported in 2017 that, quote, "Since the independence from the Soviet Union in 1991, Kazakhstan has made efforts to reduce through privatization programs the share of the state economy. Most important industries are organized into large groups of companies owned and managed by independent national managing holdings with politically powerful people on their boards and top management. But in any case, the months leading up to the uprising in Kazakhstan, and this has made it difficult to, you know, for workers to organize as well, but the months leading up to the uprising, workers were actually organizing new unions and leading massive industrial actions. And the ability to, you know, fully privatize the economy, you know, really has to be coupled with the repression toward the workers' movement. And in March, you know, striking oil workers in the Aktobe region in Western Kazakhstan actually voted to form a new trade union. As the uprising began in early January, an article that we republished in Socialist Resurgence, which interviewed Kazakh socialist Anur Kurmanov, he stated that, quote, "The form of protest initially was the classic proletarian strike. On the night of the 3rd and 4th of January, a wildcat strike began at the Tenzing oil enterprises, and soon the strike spread to neighboring regions," end of quote. Here, Russia played a more direct role. The intervention, which was labeled as a peacekeeping mission to, you know, take down terrorists through the Collective Security Treaty Organization, which is made up of these Russian-aligned states, was really, you know, a repressive force to put down a workers' movement and bolster the Kazakh leadership. Dozens were killed, thousands arrested, and hundreds injured. However, right now, actually, the workers' movement hasn't stopped. Just this Thursday, it was reported that hundreds of oil workers in the western town of Zanazen have launched a strike demanding higher salaries and better working conditions. And they're joining that effort with a strike at a nuclear facility that's also in the Western region. So despite the massive amount of repression, the growing conflict in Ukraine, the workers are, you know, pressing on with their fight. And so let's actually look at the Ukraine now. In Ukraine, we have the same story. In order for the government to drive forward this process where they're privatizing more, you know, the rest of the state-owned enterprises, it has to dismantle labor rights first. And the Ukrainian president Zelensky has been on a campaign for a while now to pass labor reforms that will further weaken what is already a weak trade union movement. And according to the 2020 article in Global Voice, the labor reform would allow, quote, "employers to terminate contracts without good reason, reduce premium for overtime pay, and obliges employees to disclose any information which may impact the performance of their work, and significantly expand the scope of the zero-hour contracts. Furthermore, it amends Ukraine's current law on trade unions, limiting the number of unions in an enterprise to two, it increases the minimum number of members required to start a trade union, and it allows directors to refuse to negotiate with unions who employ so-called managerial staff, end of quote. And the workers there are fighting back. They're not, you know, just letting this, you know, roll over them. Workers through their unions and with the help of international solidarity beat back some of the most devastating reforms. Industrial writes, quote, during the hands-off Ukraine Union Day of Action, unionists across the world delivered protest letters to Ukrainian embassies demanding that the president withdraw the draft labor under labor law undermining workers' rights and freedom of association. And here the conflict for workers is really framed in a more immediate and urgent way, because the massive Russian troop buildup around the Ukrainian border, as well as the potential for an increased direct military deployment of NATO forces, along with more US, Turkish, and EU forces in the region. And the question is, do the workers in Ukraine need the US to defend them? And we believe that no. In fact, you know, we know that the US intervention really means, because there's a long and bloody track record, you know, across the globe. And in the Ukraine specifically, the US intervention has given rise to the far right. But again, on the Russian side, this element exists as well, and it doesn't represent a progressive alternative for Ukrainian workers. So with that, I want to look at the situation in Poland and I'm trying to paint a picture of the, you know, this dynamic struggle on the ground, you know, in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. I briefly, you know, want to mention that the centrality of the struggle by women and gender nonconforming people for abortion rights in 2020, you know, which turned into this general fight against right-wing Catholic government that forced the fundamentalist right-wing Catholic regime led by the Law and Justice Party to back down. So this movement, you know, that started by women and which drew in trade unionists and farmers and broader layers of society, you know, forced this like fundamentalist right-wing Catholic government to back down from some really restrictive abortion laws, which, you know, it was a bill that would ban abortion completely and penalize women who do have abortions. And the mobilization was on a scale unknown since 1989. It occupied the streets, interrupted Sunday masses, and it blocked traffic. The mass political strike drew in, like I said, so many different layers of society. Most importantly, like the working class, you know, took this on as well. And it really transformed consciousness. Mass demonstrations continued in more than 400 towns and villages. And there was a women's strike on October 30th with more than a million demonstrators. And this was despite the exponential rise in hospitalizations and deaths due to COVID. And according to all the polls, this mass movement has the support of 2/3 to 3/4 of the population. So, you know, very important, very dynamic struggle. In Russia, the ultra-nationalistic attitude kind of permeating this Russian vision of a future empire coupled, you know, with its repressive apparatus and a weak trade union movement has created a difficult situation for workers looking to express their frustrations in a mass public way. Since Putin returned to office in 2012, there have been some significant actions, though, and ultimately, you know, they haven't really turned into the massive, you know, uprisings that we've seen in other areas. This includes 50,000 marching for peace in 2014 around the annexation of Crimea and the fighting in the Donbass region in Ukraine. And then throughout 2014, thousands joined anti-war online platforms alongside modest protests in the streets. In 2015, more significantly, unpaid workers took action across Russia. The New York Times reported, quote, in the Far East, the teachers went on strike. In Central Russia, it was the employees of a metallurgical plant. In St. Petersburg, auto workers laid down their tools. And at remote construction sites in Siberia, laborers painted on their dormitories complaints, you know, 4 months without pay. And this, you know, threatened to turn into a much broader campaign until their demands were, and it got a lot of their demands met. In 2019, Left East reported that Russia's public healthcare system was facing significant problems, and staff were coming out on strike as a result. Ambulance teams in the Penza region of central Russia organized this work to rule action. It brought out more than 100 people in support of better wages and conditions from the shop. And this was on the heels of other similar actions in the region of ambulance teams. But the largest protests in Russia in 2011, 2012, 2017, 2018 featured hundreds of thousands rallying around the issues of elections, anti-corruption, and vote rigging. And they usually take place in the context of this like kind of populist opposition to Putin. But you know, we see this is a significant expression of people discontent with the situation in Russia. And importantly, I think too, the youth are fighting and organizing for LGBTQIA plus rights. In 2020, they beat back a bill that would have banned same-sex marriage and legal recognition of transgender people. And the Russian working class has, this tremendous, in my view, a tremendous capacity for struggle in very adverse conditions, and really could potentially upset the balance of power if they can find their way into the streets to oppose imperialist intervention in Ukraine. And if that movement was joined by workers here in the US and in Europe, then we could potentially shut down any chance of war. I think though the main question to conclude here, the main question for workers everywhere in the world, especially here in the US, is whether there is leadership in the working class prepared to wage a struggle to isolate the forces of imperialism. And this includes US, NATO, and its allies, and really to mitigate their impact and turn the economic struggle for wages into a political struggle for power. And as we organize against the potential threat of war, to deny the agency of the world working class in a region, dominated by the Russian military, does a great disservice to the entire working class movement. I believe the working class in Eastern Europe, Baltic states, and across the globe can be the driving force capable of stopping this war, as Keith had laid out. And alongside them, the soldiers on all sides of this conflict who are sent to fight the war can make a significant impact, because we know that it's our labor that unearths the raw materials and shapes them and then uses them to wage war in the first place. And it's our families and friends who are the ones sent to die for a wealthy person's profit. Finally, workers of Russia, Ukraine, and other countries of the region have a great deal to unite them in their shared class interests. Of course, workers really have no borders, but particularly in these former Soviet, the states of the former Soviet Union, ultimately these working class, the working classes of these countries must struggle together, not just to solidarize with each other's labor struggles, but in a much greater struggle that can ultimately form a united federation of worker-led social states. And with that, I'll pass it off to Christine.
So how do we organize against war in this new era of inter-imperialist rivalry in the US today? It's been more than 70 years since the effort of revolutionary socialists to oppose their own government's war machine during the last World War. But we do have a great deal of experience that comes from opposition to Washington's wars against the post-World War II uprisings in the semi-colonial world, and these can guide us. After all, the view of socialists is that in each country, each imperialist country, we should be the defeat of our own ruling class's war machine by the exertion of working class political power. To bring about a defeat of the Pentagon and its NATO partners in this current adventure in Europe, and to bring about a defeat of the US with its AUKUS partners in the Pacific, requires powerful manifestations of anti-war sentiment, so powerful that they weigh heavily on the calculations of the ruling classes as do corporate interests and geopolitical hegemony. How could we possibly do something that has so much social weight? Well, the thing that makes a series of demonstrations really threatening to the ruling classes is, surprise, their breadth, their class composition, and the political stance of the demonstrators. As Keith mentioned, at the end of World War II, soldiers objecting to not being released from duty and knowing that they were going to be used as cannon fodder against China struck fear in their officers. They seem infected by the idea that the rules of industrial democracy, a say in how things were run in factories, an idea that came from the mass organizing drives of industry in the pre-war period, should apply to them in the army. They boldly organized within the army to say, bring us home. Echoing ruling class fears, an officer responded to this idea by shouting at them that this was the army, not General Motors. That is an institution over which they hoped to establish some kind of workers' management. This movement of workers in uniform with connections to their peers at the heart of US industry weighed heavily on ruling classes' decisions at that time. During the Vietnam War, this happened on a much more massive scale. The mass civilian anti-war movement was so broad and bold, and the combat experience so revelatory about real US war aims, that soldiers began to reject the discipline of their commanding officers in the field. If you watch the documentary Cyrano, Sir, you see that anti-war soldiers in Vietnam sabotaged bombing missions, got rid of gung-ho officers threatening to put them in dangerous combat situations, and so on. Those activists today who think that small individual acts of civil disobedience or property damage are somehow more radical than mass actions of millions in the streets are mistaken. It's always been the millions in the streets that made the loss of an army or an industrial action capable of mucking up the war machine, something the ruling classes had to contemplate. As we know from recent history around the US intervention in Syria, the social upheaval that comes from massive opposition to new military moves is very much part of the calculus of the ruling classes. We have slowed them down, we have stopped adventures, and we have the capacity to do much more. What about the question of political stance? The thing that made the anti-Vietnam War movement so threatening was that at its height, and at all principled subsequent anti-war organizing in the US too, was that the demonstrations and the demands were not in support of some limited, quote, peace legislation approved by the fundamentally pro-imperialist Democratic Party, but objectively in support of the complete defeat of the imperial project. US out now, end it, no preconditions, no necessary add-ons, just out now. That is, revolutionaries consciously intervened to find a way to connect the mass of anti-war activists with demands that shouted their independence from the weak and ineffective and insincere, quote, peace program of the Democratic Party. This is frightening to the ruling classes because it indicates these protests are not just a little nudge to move things along in their two-party system dog and pony show, but a real challenge to the whole bipartisan program of creating and deploying a war machine to defend US corporate profit making. What else is important besides mass action and a principled political stance? Well, there was also developed in the US the approach to a special approach to developing and calling these mass actions. Revolutionaries led the fight inside the movement to establish a united front type approach to organization. What was that? It was the idea that all of the left and working class forces and peace forces would agree to calls for demonstration in the streets around principled but limited demands that could allow and encourage the broadest assembly under their banner. At the same time, every political tendency and point of view could be expressed at the demonstrations by constituent groups. There was to be no policing of which newspapers could be sold or which banners could be carried, so that the debates within the socialist and working class movements about how to fight imperialist war could be argued out on the ground in the context of militant mass action and marching together. These actions themselves could be a school in which competing tendencies in the working class movement share their ideas with marchers, a prerequisite for the working class having the confidence to move forward toward independent political action under its own name. What did this practice mean in the best of times? During the Vietnam War and all of the wars and movements that followed, I'll share with you as a way of illustrating my first experience in participating in a national anti-war movement. It was a very long time ago, but the memory is incredibly fresh in my mind. It was about 50 years ago to this week, but still meaningful because the lessons drawn from these experiences by revolutionaries in the United States from anti-war struggles like this carried us through the efforts to fight the U.S. assault on the Salvadoran and Nicaraguan revolutions in the 80s, through the first Gulf War and the bombing of Yugoslavia in the 90s, through the invasions and occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq after 2003, and the U.S. and Russian interventions to crush the Syrian revolution. So what was my experience? I came a bit late to the anti-Vietnam War movement. February 1971, I hitchhiked to D.C., to attend a youth anti-war conference. I walked in the room held 2,500 activists representing little anti-war groups like mine. And for 2 days, we debated resolutions based on the various strategic and tactical ideas floating around the movement and concluded with the majority deciding to build a big mass action on April 24th, 1971 in DC. Every conceivable point of view about what to do was before the body in the shape of dozens of resolutions that raised major questions of political principle and orientation. These resolutions, and as currently exists in our movements, advocating everything from privileging electoral work in support of the Democratic Party to orienting demands around legislation in Congress to days of civil disobedience to direct action targeting property that only students would likely join. The debates carried out over the 2 days led to the majority choosing a course of action, a majority course of action, a demand out now and an orientation, legal mass action that could bring veterans and soldiers, workers in their unions, parents of those deployed in combat into the streets in the largest demonstration against imperialism of the US government to that date. It was about 400,000. And similarly impressive on the West Coast. So it was like the experience in one sense that we had last summer, that demonstration, when the mass participation in the BLM demonstrations made it simply impossible to say that their demands were fringe demands. That the mass action of the past and a tactic we tried to carry forward over all these decades was organized on the United Front basis, on the United Front of a special type, we called it, meant that the coalition unity was there, but every constituent group was encouraged to come with their own contingents, their own banners to show all the intersections between war, poverty, the anti-labor attacks, police brutality, racism, sexism, homophobia, national oppression, and so on. The wars abroad and the war at home were integrated in the most organic way. In that period, there were distinct organizing poles for the massive movement of anti-war veterans, for Chicano liberation, for the women's movement, the Black liberation movement, and all these forces built and publicized contingents with their own demands with the help of the central organizing offices of the big anti-war groups. The fact that all of the forces came together, the working class left and came together in these giant conferences and debated and voted, gave unprecedented authority to the call for that April march. And that unprecedented authority meant that the action could become a focal point to which also social movement sectors could bring their analysis and their messages to hundreds of thousands of people to whom they had never had access before. So that experience was a great conquest of the movement against war in the United States. We've only been able to repeat it fully in episodic ways since then, but it must remain our goal. We did in part were able to carry it out, the movement against the war, during all the interventions from the 80s, U.S. interventions, the 80s, the 90s, first Gulf War, the early years on the War on Terror, and the horrendous invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. We should remember that February 15th, 2003, just days before the invasion of Iraq, global anti-war actions were in their millions were so large that the New York Times reporter Patrick Tyler famously said, "There are two superpowers in the world, Washington and the global anti-war movement." Year after year, utilizing to the best we could these lessons, these fundamental lessons that were conquered during Vietnam and then reaffirmed over the decades, meant that year after year, mass actions against the Iraq war became schools for radicalizing youth and workers. In 2012, we were able to organize 15,000 to march in Chicago on the occasion of the NATO G8 summit there. This is particularly important to remember. Only 10 years ago, we were capable of mounting a mass action against the exact kind of provocation that the US and NATO are currently carrying out around Ukraine. These actions, at which anti-war veterans could speak their truth about the reality of war, its real purpose, the way they've been treated by the US government, acted as a powerful challenge to the attempts of the far right to organize soldiers. Imagine how important that could be today when the far right is having a field day preying on alienated soldiers and veterans with false analyses of the root of their problems. So basically, from 1965 to 2015 or so, revolutionary socialists and allies had been carrying out their international duties in the US by struggling to build the largest movement possible at any given time and using these key lessons from our earlier victories to make the movement a space in which our class can experience mass democratic decision-making, their independent class power, and the potential for further political development in that direction. Now you could say, so what? The wars continue, the war machine's intact. Well, this is true, but to paraphrase the radical art critic John Berger, really mass demonstrations are like rehearsals for revolution. That is, they're moments in which our class gets to experience their agency, their place in history, to sense their potential power, to be part of mobilizing the majority in the interest of human needs instead of profit. Where people can imagine using their power in the street, but also using their power to start and stop war production, to start and stop transportation, communication, to imagine taking the army back for the defense of working class rights against the bosses. And when that process is happening, the ruling class knows it. It affects their decisions. It threatens the very foundations of their order. So these actions, while they did not dismantle the US war machine, of course, surely made Washington's ability to consolidate puppet regimes for oil extraction and so on more difficult. They surely influenced the next episode of elite calculations about when to go to war. And finally, we created the time and spaces over and over again for the working classes in the victimized nations to rise up in their own interest, or the working classes in within other imperialist powers to rise up in their own interest. When we carry out this work, we create the spaces in which working people in the US can resist toxic nationalism and chauvinism and develop new worldviews that include new allies and a clear vision of a society based on human needs. We create time for demoralized soldiers in uniform and veterans to process their experience and consider new political options. In other words, we fight for concessions from the war makers in a way that makes us winners no matter what. We fight in a way that ensures that when we come out of it, a new layer of working people have been won to the vanguard of the movements for social change. Now, in the first month of this year, Congress voted up the largest war budget in US history, $768 billion for war and pillage, for an expansion of an apocalyptic nuclear arsenal that now ominously will include small nuclear weapons, the use of which they hope to normalize. This war spending is meant to be used, and it's meant to be used despite the austerity in which working people are living. It will be used to punish capitalist competitors, to suppress working class rebellion around the world, to steal land and resources, to fight indigenous opposition to extractivism and deforestation, to impede the free flow of migrating humans to safety. Each billion spent on war is a billion not spent on human needs, social services, affordable housing, reparations to the Black community, to Native peoples, for loss and mitigation to the less developed world around climate change. Each billion spent on war is a billion that will encourage repression and threaten civil liberties. Each billion spent is a billion contributing to fossil fuel emissions that are dooming our species. Thus, the fight against war is certainly not alien from the regular daily experiences of working people. It must encompass all the issues that are daily threatening people's sense of confidence in their own livelihood and future. So it means that we have to integrate the fight against war and can integrate the fight against war in every social movement and in every labor struggle for human needs. We have to take every opportunity to explain there's no imperialist power on earth, starting with Washington, but not stopping there, whose bullets and missiles and drones will make it easier for working people to defend our lives and standard of living. So as we go into this terrifying period of time when inter-imperialist rivalry is taking center stage, we have to think out action with the lessons of the past, with the lessons from World War I and II, with the lessons of the last 60 years in the United States, where we worked to model forms of organization that could bring the largest number of working people possible into the experience of action. But we also have to take note of the special challenges this time around, not really new, but to look anew at some of the special things that are in guaranteed to try to impede our progress. The briefest look at the news suggests that some of the immediate political obstacles we will face are profound. The Democratic Party apparatus is mobilized to beat the war drums as a way to package their party and their candidates for the next election. At the same time, and that's by far the greatest threat to our success. At the same time, the far right commentator Tucker Carlson is urging moderation and a retreat from fanning the flames of war. Is the anti-imperialist far right an ally? Should they be part of our project? Hardly. They will only serve to keep the oppressed nationalities and those without papers and unionists out of a new anti-war movement. Yet some anti-war organizers will advocate teaming up with them. This must be resisted. It will be deadly to our cause. In addition, we have the special problem of the current consciousness of the actually existing leadership of anti-war organizations. Many of them are trying to shape the politics of organization and demonstrations in a very unhelpful way. They all tend to be folks who see Russia or China as an ally against the predations of US imperialism. And they want to assume that the anti-war movement will be organized on this basis, that those who participate will want to hear speeches, will want to pass out flyers, will want to listen to radio shows in which this is the voice of the anti-war movement takes this position. That's not true. That's not the position of the majority. We need to fight to have a united democratic anti-war movement where there's spaces for those of us who understand, have our position on the role of the new imperialisms, as well as to be part of the movement as well. So right now we're in a period, and think of the working forces, working classes from these countries with whom we want to have allies. they need to know that our movement is open to understanding and organizing solidarity with their plight. Now, right now, we're in a period where we don't really have an anti-war movement. We had a whole series of actions around the country. They were extremely modest responses. We numbered in the dozens rather than the tens of thousands. So it's very clear that our goal, our task right now is to build and consolidate anti-war bases within the social movements and within our unions that currently exist. We know there's hundreds of thousands of people who see that war and global warming are deeply intertwined, and that each Pentagon deployment shortens the time until the carbon budget has been completely expended. It's very clear that militarism and imperialist war are being unleashed to defend corporate land grabs for industrial agriculture and extraction and other environmental threats to human existence. It's clear that militarism unchallenged grows police brutality and grows far right militias. We have to be active in the spaces of the social movements that are against all these things and explain the importance, the relationship of the Pentagon and NATO to these issues and the importance of responding directly to US war moves and threats of war. We have to win those in the streets today and our coworkers in our unions to the big goal of open democratic conferences that take the control of movements against war and warming and calls for action out of the hands of NGOs oriented to the Democratic Party and put it into the hands of activists who want a social movement turned outward to engaging the majority of the population and raising their consciousness and level of action. If we're successful in building these bases, we can do the kind of work that will tie the hands of the Pentagon again, will win a new layer of working classes to the idea that their task is the creation of a clearly working class anti-war party with its eyes on power. So no US troops to Eastern Europe, no US and Russian intervention in the Ukraine, solidarity with anti-war workers and farmers in the Ukraine, Russia, and in Ukraine, Russia, and the rest of Europe, money for public health, affordable housing, emergency transition away from fossil fuels, not war. Thanks.